Ever heard of mushroom semantic domain? And we have a group, gamma. So we want this to be a discrete subgroup. So the automorphism group of D is some Lie group, so we want a discrete subgroup of the automorphism group of D, and I want it to act freely, so in order to get rid of possible problems. So this means that if gamma X is equal to X, and that implies with gamma and X and D, it implies that, gamma is equal to 1. Then we can take the quotient, and I claim that this has a nice complex structure again. So this is a complex manifold. And it has two properties. It has the quotient topology, so in other words, the set here is open if and only if its inverse image up here is open, and call this map pi. Then with the structure here, the function down here is holomorphic, so functions of the complex numbers down here will be holomorphic if and only if, when you compose it with pi, you get a holomorphic function on here. So of course, if this structure, a holomorphic function down here, is just a holomorphic function up here, which is invariant under the action of gamma. So first thing you might ask is, why do you bother passing to the quotient down here? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One is that there are a lot of wonderful theorems about functions, genuine functions. For example, the Riemann-Roch theorem. It's not so easy to work with a set of functions which are invariant under some group action. But more importantly for us is that this up here is definitely not an algebraic variety, whereas this one here has some hope of being an algebraic variety. And that, of course, is important because if you know algebraic geometry is easier than complex analysis, polynomials being easier than power series. But also what's really important for us, of course, is that if it's an algebraic variety, you can talk about it being defined over some number field. That makes no sense for a complex manifold. So the proof of this, if you've seen the proof of this in the case of the upper half plane in a discrete subgroup of SL2, then you've seen the proof in general, because it's exactly the, I mean, the proof that works for the upper half plane under this SL2Z works here. Let me just recall what the essential point is. So the key point is that using topology, you prove that if you have a, let's call it a P belong to D, then there exists an open neighborhood U of P such that use disjoint from all the translates of gamma U. Right, so in other words, if we have, so we have this neighborhood, open neighborhood of P, and when you project it down to pi U, this is 1-to-1. This doesn't meet any of the translates. So this is 1-to-1. So if, obviously, maybe by shrinking U, I can choose it to be a coordinate neighborhood of P. In other words, I can choose it so there's a, it's isomorphic to an open subset in C to the N for some N. If this is 1-to-1, then I can just reverse things and get a coordinate neighborhood down of pi of P down here. That's That's the central part of the argument. And this is just topology. As I said, it's just the same as in the one-dimensional case. So we get a complex manifold, at least, down here. Now, which discrete subgroups do we want? To consider, well, we only want to consider a big one, so. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean if the gamma is big, then the modulo gamma, the quotient space, should be small. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, by definition, D is a Riemannian manifold. So it has a volume form. So what I mean by this is that if you integrate, so the volume form, everything's invariant under the action of gamma. This is acting by automorphisms to preserving everything. So you get a volume form down here. So you want that the integral, the volume of this is finite. We're not going to be too concerned with this, but let me just check that this is true. This really was what's going on in the classic case. So if you take the upper half plane, then the volume form is just dx dy over y squared. And if you want to integrate over get the volume of the quotient, you just have to integrate over a fundamental domain. So we want to integrate this over fundamental domain is. So this is supposed to be the unit circle, and this is minus a half, and this is plus a half out here. So if we integrate this thing over this, over the interior up here. And well, probably everyone's done this sort of thing, but we can make life easy for you by taking a bigger domain and integrating over the whole thing across here, then this just becomes the integral up here from square root of 3 over 2 to infinity of dy over y squared, which is less than infinity. Okay. So if I take, in other words, what I'm doing is I'm taking, excuse me, I should be taking the classical case SL2Z. So if you take the quotient of the upper half plane by the SL2Z, then the quotient has finite measure because the fundamental domain has finite measure. Now, I mean, if I on the other hand, if I took instead of this, if I took gamma to be the set of matrices like that, that's also a discrete group. But in this case, this is just all the translations by integers. So the fundamental domain in this case would be the whole thing here. If you try integrating this over this thing here, you get infinity, of course. So this is not big in this sense here, and gamma equal to 1 is also not big. But gamma equal to this is big in a sense. Well, when this is true, I'll say that gamma is cofinite volume. Well, we're really interested in if I give you a subgroup there, a discrete group, obviously it's very boring to try and decide whether it's cofinite volume. You have to work out all these integrals. So instead, we start at the opposite end and look at all the arithmetic subgroups. So now, if I have a G an algebraic group over Q, then every algebraic group over Q has a finite dimensional representation, so that's basically on a finite dimensional vector space. If you choose the basis for the vector space, that tells us that we have a injective homomorphism of this into GLN for some n. This is over Q. And then I'll just say that the intersection of GQ, GLNZ, so this in fact will be a discrete subgroup of cofinite volume, so this is certainly a discrete subgroup it's a subgroup of GQ, so we'll call this an arithmetic subgroup. So any group of this type is an arithmetic subgroup, and any group commensurable with it is an arithmetic subgroup. Commensurable with GQ intersect GLN. So roughly, commensurable means two groups are commensurable. They're commensurable if the intersection has finite index in both of them. So an arithmetic subgroup of an algebraic group over Q is any group, roughly speaking, which is commensurable, more or less the same size as a group you get by just taking matrices in GQ with integer coefficients. So for example, of course, all the familiar congruent subgroups of SL2Q are arithmetic subgroups. And so that's arithmetic subgroups of an algebraic group over Q. And if I have a Lie group, so suppose that, let's say H is a connected real Lie group. Then I wanted to find an arithmetic subgroup in here. Well, if I have a G, which is an algebraic group over Q, and I have a surjective map from the identity component of the real points of my algebraic group onto the connected Lie group, and the kernel is compact. And I have an arithmetic subgroup in here, so in other words, it's really sitting inside G of Q. Then, let's call this map something then. This would be an arithmetic subgroup in here. So this is some nice, so, let me say it again. If I have a connected real Lie group, and a subgroup of the group, connected real Lie group, will be arithmetic if you can find an algebraic group over Q. A surjective homomorphism with compact kernel, such and an arithmetic subgroup here in that sense over there, such that this maps onto that. And it turns out that in the situation here, when you have a Hermitian symmetric domain, then, and you have an arithmetic subgroup of the identity component of its automorphism group, that will be a discrete subgroup of cofinite volume, and it'll act freely if the group is torsion free, in fact. So, I should say that if H is equal to and and gamma and containing H is arithmetic, and gamma is finite volume. This implies, so first of all, it implies that gamma is discrete, and it will act freely if gamma is torsion free as well. And you can, if you have an arithmetic subgroup, you can always, it contains, by shrinking it a bit, there's another arithmetic subgroup containing it, which will be torsion free. No, this is automatic. The point is, if gamma is arithmetic, this is automatic.
No.
No matter how hard you try, you can't get it in this fashion. Yeah, but the group, the automorphism group is actually the quotient of SL2 modulo plus or minus 1. If you take SL2 Z, then that has torsion elements, so it doesn't act freely. But if you go past a congruent subgroup, then when you divide out by the plus or minus 1, then that will be torsion free in a way. It will act freely on the upper half plane. Well, up here I just wanted to act freely because otherwise. And in the one dimensional case, if it doesn't act freely, then it doesn't matter too much. But in the higher dimensional case, it causes more problems if it doesn't act freely. I don't want to think about it. Yeah, I guess all this works. You don't need to, in the one-dimensional case, you don't need to assume that that's freely, I think, it more or less. Well, you have trouble defining the complex structure, I think. That's a ramification point. But in the high-dimensional case, all the time I'm going to assume that my groups are small enough so that they act freely. We're going to consider the whole towers of things as we shrink gamma. And I'm not going to worry too much about what happens really at the bottom. Because so now I should discuss a little bit about complex manifolds and algebraic varieties. One very notable exception. My varieties are going to be non-singular varieties. So algebraic variety. The reason for this is I want to relate algebraic varieties with complex manifolds, and if I allow things, my varieties to be singular, I have to allow my complex manifolds to be singular, and I have to explain what all that meant. And I don't want to bother. So if I have an algebraic variety, meaning non-singular algebraic variety, then I can associate to that a complex manifold, which I'll write it V upper analytic. And this is not very difficult to do. I just list some of the properties we want. So the first property, well, I should also say what I mean by algebraic varieties, since there are different ways of thinking about them. But they're all the same. My algebraic varieties are only going to have closed points. So if you like schemes, then you have to throw away all the non-closed points. If I say that, then whatever way you think of algebraic variety, it's more or less the same. So, of course, we want that they have the same underlying subset. And we want that if something's open for the Zariski topology, then it better be open for the complex topology. And then if V happens to be affine n-space, then the complex manifold we associate with that is just C to the n. Now, there's only one more condition we really have to require in this nice case. Let me write it down and explain what it means. So, if we have an atom map of algebraic varieties, then that should give a local isomorphism of complex manifolds. So a map of algebraic varieties is atom if it's an isomorphism on tangent spaces. And one difference between algebraic geometry and analysis is that the inverse function theorem doesn't hold. In whatever analysis you're doing, if you have an isomorphism on tangent spaces, it gives you a local isomorphism. But that's definitely not true for an algebraic geometry. So I claim that there's a unique functor from algebraic non-singular algebraic varieties over the complex numbers to complex manifolds with these three properties. And the key observation is that if I have a variety, then it has a rather easy result that a non-singular variety is covered by affine varieties which have atom maps to An, where N is the dimension of V. So, yeah, that's the theorem, an easy theorem in algebraic geometry. It's proved in my course notes on algebraic geometry. Yeah, I mean, the way you prove it is you just take the functions generating them, the maximal ideal at the point, and they define a map to An, which is a tal on an open set. So if you have this, then, so these are the Zariski opens in here, so they're going to be open for the complex topology, So this is actually a tal onto an open subset. There's a wrong bad notation. Onto an open subset in here. I'm going to require these to be local isomorphisms. So what that means is that any subset here which maps bijectively onto an open subset here has got to be open up here. And in fact, it's got to be any subset here which maps bijectively on an open subset here, this map has got to give you actually an isomorphism for the complex structures. That really forces what the complex structure on here has to be, and then it tells you what the complex structure has to be on here. But anyway, it's not. It's not too hard. I mean, if the variety is given by a bunch of equations, then of the complex polynomial equations over the complex numbers, then the same equations are going to give you a complex manifold. So let's not make a big deal about that. So we have this functor from, so given a variety, you get a complex manifold. And we want to look at this functor and what's its properties. Well, not. First of all, it's a face, obviously a faithful functor. You know, if I know what the map is, the regular map on the varieties is, if I know what the map on the points is, I know what the regular map is. So that's certainly true, but it's very far from being a full. If you can have maps, if you have two algebraic varieties, you can have maps of them as complex manifolds, which are not regular, not algebraic. The most obvious example, if I take A1 and A1, then the corresponding complex manifold is C and C, and there's certainly holomorphic maps from C to C, which are not regular. For example, the exponential function is not a polynomial function. So there are many more maps of manifolds than there are of algebraic varieties, which is bad to study. The other thing that's bad is that if you take it's very far from being surjective. If you take a complex manifold, typically it's not going to be algebraic. I mean, to be algebraic means that you can define it using polynomial equations. You can write down zillions and zillions of manifolds, and why should they be defined by polynomial equations? So the problem is that your complex manifold may not come from an algebraic variety, and if it does come from an algebraic variety, it may come from more than one, which is, in other words, you might have two algebraic varieties, non-singular algebraic varieties, which become isomorphic when you consider them as complex manifolds, but they're not isomorphic as algebraic varieties. So this is really very bad. Let me give you some examples. The problems, there are basically two problems. You're trying to, if you have a complex manifold and you want to see whether it's algebraic, there are two problems you run into. And the first one is that it might have no, so suppose you have a complex manifold and you'd like to know whether it's the complex points of an algebraic variety. It might have no nice compactification. So I'll just write them down and explain what these mean. And they might have not enough functions. So when you're dealing with curves, there are a few positive results about this sort of thing. If you have a projective non-singular curve, then you take its complex points, you get a compact Riemann surface. And in this case, it goes both ways. In this case, to give a compact Riemann surface is the same as to give a projective non-singular curve. Every compact Riemann surface comes, this is not so hard, you can find it in books and things. Every compact Riemann surface is the complex points of a projective non-singular curve, and maps even are in fact algebraic. So we can move one step away, so let's look at affine non-singular curves. Well, every affine non-singular curve can be embedded into a projective non-singular curve. And what's the difference? So if you have a curve, the open subsets are just the whole thing minus the finite number of points. So every affine non-singular curve is just a projective non-singular curve, which you've taken out a finite number of points. So obviously, they correspond to compact Riemann surfaces. Minus a finite number of points. Well, I claim that there are lots and lots of Riemann non-compact Riemann surfaces that cannot be written in this fashion. For example, if I have such a thing, if I have a function, a holomorphic function on a compact Riemann surface minus a finite number of points, which is, suppose that f is holomorphic and bounded. Well, if it's bounded, it's bounded around a point, so you can extend it to the whole compact surface. And if you have a holomorphic function on a whole compact Riemann surface, it's going to be constant. So if I look at the upper half plane, then there's a nice map, z goes to z minus I over z plus I into the disk, which is non-constant. So this proves that the upper half plane is not an algebraic curve. It's not the complex points of an algebraic curve. So you didn't have to look very far. And the real reason is that this is no nice compactification, because in fact this map here is an isomorphism. The upper half plane is isomorphic to the interior of the unit disk. And okay, so you have the unit disk. How do you compactify the unit disk? Now, of course, you want compactification, which is compatible with the complex structure. Well, there's an obvious way to compactify the unit disk, namely just take the closed disk. But then that makes no sense from the point of view of algebraic geometry, because from the point of view of algebraic geometry, this is something of one dimension, and you're adding something of one real dimension. So you're trying to add something of dimension 1/2. So this is the whole problem. And the point is that algebraic varieties do have nice compactifications from the real point of view. You compactify it by adding on something of codimension 2. Okay, so the sort of first thing we wrote down was not a... Well, that's the same sort of argument works for all Hermitian symmetric domains. And none of these are algebraic varieties. The same sort of argument. A little more complicated. The other problem is not enough functions. That's not the only problem. And everybody knows, I hope, that if you take the complex numbers modulo a lattice, and this is, in fact, an algebraic variety, because you take the Weierstrass P and P prime functions into P2, and you get an elliptic curve. You go one dimension, one complex dimension, you take C2 modulo a lattice. If you choose your lattice at random, this will not be an algebraic variety, because, you see, if it was an algebraic variety, you would have the regular functions would form a field of transcendence degree. They have a variety of dimension n, and the rational functions on it form a field of transcendence degree n over the complex numbers. Now you can write down lots of lattices inside C2 so that you don't get two independent, transcendentally algebraically independent meromorphic functions on it. So this may have too few meromorphic functions. So certainly every rational function, if it was an algebraic variety, then every rational function would be meromorphic, but it doesn't have enough meromorphic functions. So, and in fact, as I say, if for most lattices in C2, that will be true, that it won't have enough. It won't have two algebraically independent meromorphic functions. So there are lots of problems. But the amazing thing is, well, before I state the theorem, let me state one positive result so that you don't give up in despair. So this is Chell's theorem. So let me say that if you have an algebraic variety or a complex manifold, then its projective, if it's isomorphic in the appropriate category, to a closed subvariety or submanifold of Pn C for some n. So, of course, you know this for varieties. So we just say that a complex manifold is projective if it's isomorphic to a closed submanifold of Pn C. And then the theorem is that projective algebraic varieties, well, the functor from projective algebraic varieties to projective complex manifolds is an equivalence of categories. So the projective this is an equivalence of categories. So in particular, if you have two projective algebraic varieties, non-singular, you look at their points and you get a complex manifold. And if you have a holomorphic map from one to the other, then it's actually a regular map. This is really a little surprising. You take two projective varieties, take a holomorphic map from one to the other, then it's actually a regular map. So it's actually given by polynomials. So the point is that, of course, holomorphic map means basically it's given by power series. But a regular map means it's given by polynomials. So if the varieties are projective, then if it's given by a power series, then it's automatically given by polynomials. This is a little surprising, perhaps. But this theorem is not deep at all, in fact. You can find it in Shafarevich's book on algebraic geometry. It's in the towards the end of the book, but if you know the basic definitions, then you can read the proof. Shafarevich, in fact, has a nice discussion of what I've been talking about as well. So after all this negative stuff, I can state the theorems. So the first theorem is usually called the Bailly-Borel. Of course, there is earlier work by Ziegler and Sataki, particularly others. But it says that if you take a quotient like this, as we have up here, where this is a Hermitian symmetric domain, and this is let's take an arithmetic subgroup of the automorphism group, and let's call this d gamma. Then the theorem is that d gamma, in fact, is algebraic. Now, that's not the whole story, of course, because it might have more than one algebraic structure, as I mentioned. But so how do I state it? So d gamma has a canonical realization as a risky open subset of a projective variety. So I write d gamma star. And you point out that this one here is singular. Okay. So so if I take the quotient information symmetric domain by an arithmetic subgroup, so I want this to say it acts freely. Yeah, I better put that down. Then this is a complex manifold, and I claim it has, you can realize it in a canonical way, as the risky open subset of a projective variety. And the projective variety is very singular. This one here is singular. This one is non-singular. This one is very singular. Same, yeah. The proof of this is, yeah, so it's the same proof as in the, well, the proof is hard. The proof, but it's the same idea. I mean, how do you, since the question was raised, how do you prove this? Well, how do you prove this? Well, how do you compactify the modular curves? Well, what you do is you add the cusps. More precisely, you take H1 union the rational points on the real line and the point at infinity, so it's P1Q. So let's call this H1 star. And then gamma modulo H1 star is a, you prove that this is a compact. The point is that gamma still acts on the whole thing. This is a compact Riemann surface. Now, if you're lazy, you just say, well, it's a compact Riemann surface. So I had a theorem up here a moment ago that said that compact Riemann surfaces are algebraic, projective algebraic curves. If you want to do a little more work, you get actually get an embedding of this into a projective space, some projective space, using modular forms of high enough weight. Now the structure of the proof over here is exactly the same, except it's really it's much more complicated. So what you do is you take your Schmittian symmetric domain and you add components in some systematic way, and then you gamma whacked on the whole thing, and you get a. In this case, even you get singularities, so you're not talking about complex manifolds anymore there. But then you construct enough basically modular forms to embed into projective space. And then even once you embed into projective space, you're not done, because you have to check that. Suppose that you compactify in this way, then you get this and you embed it into projective space and Charles, well, then you have a problem that it's not a manifold. So there are singularities, but anyway, Charles' theorem tells you that this will be projective, but then you still have to check that this is a Zariski open subset of this. And the proof is hard. It's about 80 pages, and I don't think it's got any much shorter. I should say there's, keep hoping someone will. Well, the thing is, one really needs the proof they give. One really needs to know what this is. But I keep hoping that someone will find a nice general theorem that will just imply this. And the case that this quotient here is compact, there is a theorem. There's the Kandare embedding theorem, which tells you that this is algebraic. And people, Nadeau and Tsuchi, generalized that and found a general theorem which applies when the boundary is dimension zero. And I think Mok and Zong have actually found a proof of a general theorem which implies this in general. So you can avoid Bailey-Borel and if you just want to know this is algebraic, but the Mok-Zong proof at first sight doesn't look any easier, and you need this. So this is really a problem in the theory of Shimura-Vidi, since we need this theorem, and it's really, for what we're doing in this course, we only need to know this is algebraic, actually. We don't need to know too much about the structure of things, but it's a problem. One doesn't want to have to appeal to such a thing. But as I say, at least the structure of the proof is the same. Very, very heavy group theory. Well, that's the first theorem, and I said this is somehow the whole thing, construction is canonical. But it doesn't exclude the possibility that maybe someone will come along and find a different way of making this into an algebraic variety. The theorem of Borel so how do I want to state this? Yeah, so let me now write. So I'll write d gamma for this is an algebraic with its canonical structure. So the Bailey-Borel canonical. So the Bailey-Borel tells us that there's a canonical algebraic variety which has this as its complex minimum. Notice there's this thing up here that these up there, none of them are algebraic varieties, but these things are all algebraic varieties. It's quite striking. So suppose that these are a non-singular quasi-projective variety. So you can embed it into it. Well, it's not a strong condition. And suppose that we have a holomorphic map from here to the complex manifold d gamma. So this is holomorphic. Then this map is regular. This is also surprising. Somewhere I said that gamma acts freely. the first example that comes to mind, if you take the upper half plane modulo SL2Z, then the theorem fails for that because this is just isomorphic to the affine line. As I mentioned, the silly maps from the affine line to the affine, holomorphic maps from the affine line to the affine line, which are not regular. But this doesn't violate the theorem because over here, the conditions are the same as the conditions over here. It acts freely, so it has to be dividing up by a torsion-free subgroup. So even when you divide out by this, this has torsion. So if you replace this by gamma 3 or something like that, then the theorem holds. So this is, okay. So the theorem is that if you have any non-singular quasi-projective variety, any holomorphic map from here to here is actually a regular map from V to D gamma with the structure that you get from Baby Borel. So this tells you that the gamma structure, the Baby Borel structure on this complex manifold is actually unique. You see, if I had, well, if I had another variety, which was, had another non-singular variety such that this complex manifold is isomorphic to this complex manifold, then this, as a variety, is isomorphic to this as a variety. Okay. So the Borel theorem says more than that, but it says that the structure of an algebraic variety on D gamma provided by the Baby Borel theorem was actually unique. So let me say a little bit about the proof of Borel's theorem, at least. So we need to, so let me write, so D1 is the disk. And let me write, so I'm using star for compactifications, let me write D cross for the punctured disk. Now what we need to do is we have to understand what space like this looks like. Well, unfortunately, I don't even understand what D1 cross D1 looks like. So let's change things slightly. So let's take the affine line, which is K over a field. If I remove a point, then of course I get this. And if I take K cross cross K cross, so of course, then what do I get? So if I take the product of the affine line with the origin, remove twice, then I get the plane with the chordate axes removed. Okay, so this is just all the points with no coordinate zero. So I've changed convention in going from here to here. So the down here, this is all the black stuff and the white stuff is removed, so. Well, you get the idea. If I take this one here, then I just get three space with all the coordinate planes removed. If I took K cross, cross K, then this would just be the plane, it would just be the plane with the y-axis removed. So if I take a whole bunch of things like this, then what I get, in fact, is I get k to the r plus s with some of the coordinate hyperplanes removed. Okay, this is what this looks like. So this is just k to the r plus s, and you're removing some planes of dimension r plus s minus 1, and the planes all meet transversely. And this is what this looks like, too, except it's... So it's just, this is just sitting inside d to the d1 to the r plus s, and you've removed some of the coordinate hyperplane. So you remove something at codimension, complex codimension 1, and it consists of just multi disks like this, which cross transversely. Okay, so the key part to point to Borel's theorem is the following. So key result is that if you have a holomorphic map here into D gamma, one of our quotients, then it extends to dr plus s into the Bailey-Borel compactification. So the Borel proves that any time you have a holomorphic map from something that looks like this into here, product of some punctured disk, then it extends to this. So let me just say that what's the starting point of this result? Probably a lot of you have seen an example of this, and this is a theorem that looks like that, looks the same shape as that. This is called the Big Picard theorem. The Big Picard theorem says that if you have a function on the punctured disk, and it has any punctured disk, if a function has an essential singularity, holomorphic function is an essential singularity at a point, then any open, if you take open disk, then you get a map from here to the complex numbers. And no matter how small you take the open disk about the essential singularity, the function will either map onto the complex numbers or omit at most one value. So the S omits at most one point of C. So if you have an essential singularity, it means the singularity you can't get rid of by multiplying the function by Z to the N, then it really is really a wild function. It maps either onto the whole of C or it might omit one point in C. This is called the Big Picard theorem. It's a very old theorem and some things at least stated in elementary books. Has a really nice proof in using modular curves, actually. So what's this got to do with that? Well, we can restate this as saying that if it omits two, if you have a function on the punctured disk, if it omits two values, then it has it worth the pole back here. Well, if it has a pole, that means it actually extends to a function to the Riemann sphere. So if you have a function on the punctured disk to the complex number that emits two values, then it actually extends to a function on the whole disk into the Riemann sphere. Another way of saying that is that if I have a function on D1 cross into the Riemann sphere, minus 3 points, then it extends to holomorphic function into here. This is the same as that. So if it emits 3 points in here, it emits 2 points in the plane, and therefore it has a pole, and therefore it extends to the function here. So this projective, so the Riemann sphere minus 3 points has this really curious property that if you take any holomorphic from the punctured disk into it, then it extends to the whole disk into the obvious compactification of this. And now I maybe see that this is a big generalization of that fact. That these varieties have these complex manifold has this really curious property that if you have any holomorphic function from here, then it actually extends to this into an obvious compactification of this. Now let me just quickly say how one, given that, how does one I guess I'll just say it in one go. Given this, how does one derive this? Well, given a now one has to apply another big theorem. Hiranaka's resolution of singularities tells us that given a known singular quasi-projective variety, you can embed it into a projective variety. Such that the technical term is that e star minus v is a divisor with normal crossings. What that means is that it looks locally like, so I should say that v contained in v star looks locally like, for the complex topology, like d1 cross to the r cross d1 to the s contained inside d1 to the s. So it just looks like a locally like some disk where you move some coordinate axes from coordinate hyperplanes. So this is a big theorem. This is the Hiranaka's resolution of singularities, which is a Fields-Middle theorem. Same fields. So given a non-singular variety, you can embed it in the projective variety. And so locally, V sitting inside here looks like this sitting inside here. So you apply, so we have a map from here, holomorphic map from here to here. And applying this theorem, it extends to holomorphic map here. And now these are both projective varieties, so you apply Chell's theorem. And you know that this is algebraic, and therefore this is algebraic. So the, okay. Well, we're given a holomorphic map here, and you want to prove it's regular algebraic map. So we have a holomorphic map here. Locally, this just looks like this sitting inside here. So we apply that theorem to extend it to a holomorphic map, not into D gamma now, but into D gamma star, so I have to get into bigger. But this is a projective variety, and this is a projective variety. And Chell's theorem tells us that any holomorphic map of projective, projective varieties is regular. Yeah, but Chell's theorem still applies. Okay.